on Sunday, May 11th, 2003, only 2 months after the invasion began. The Washington Post ran a headline on its front page, "Frustrated U.S. Arms Team to Leave Iraq, Task Force Unable to Find Any Weapons." The newspaper reported that the 75th Exploitation Task Force of the United States Army, quote, "the group directing all known U.S. search weapons, search efforts for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq," was, quote, "winding down operations without finding proof that President Saddam Hussein kept clandestine stocks of outlawed arms." The article quoted Army Colonel Richard McPhee, a leader of the task force, as saying, "My unit has not found chemical weapons. That's a fact. And I'm 47 years old, having a birthday in one of Saddam Hussein's palaces on a lake in the middle of Baghdad. It's surreal. The whole thing is surreal." Referring to the weapons of mass destruction, McPhee said, "Do I know where they are? I wish I did. But we will find them, or not. I don't know. I'm being honest here." 2 weeks prior to this Washington Post article, the British newspaper The Independent reported that intelligence agencies on both sides of the Atlantic were furious that briefings they gave political leaders were distorted in the rush to war with Iraq. The newspaper quoted a, quote, high-level UK source who said, quote, "they ignored intelligence assessments which said Iraq was not a threat." And then we have May 1, 2005, the London Sunday Times revealing the Downing Street memos. Minutes, official minutes, of a secret meeting that took place in July of 2002 at 10 Downing Street, Prime Minister Blair's residence, at which he heard a briefing from the senior British intelligence officer Richard Dearlove, the head of MI6, the equivalent of our Central Intelligence Agency. And Mr. Dearlove, these minutes record, came back from his meetings in Washington with high-level U.S. government officials to report that by the summer of 2002, President Bush had decided to overthrow Iraqi President Saddam Hussein by launching a war which would be, quote, "justified by the conjunction of terrorism and WMD, weapons of mass destruction." Dearlove continues, "but the intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy." If these minutes are true, if these minutes are accurate, then the President of the United States has engaged in a conspiracy to deceive and mislead the United States Congress and the American people about the basis for going to war against Iraq. Such conduct constitutes a high crime under Article 2, Section 4 of the United States Constitution, which states, "the President, Vice President, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors."
You're listening to the Citizens Tribunal on Iraq from Binghamton, New York. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, or WRFN Nashville.
The question must now be asked, with the release of the Downing Street minutes, whether the President has committed impeachable offenses. Is it a high crime to engage in a conspiracy to deceive and mislead the United States Congress and the American people about the basis for taking the nation into war? Is it a high crime? Is it a high crime to manipulate intelligence so as to allege falsely a national security threat posed to the United States as a means of trying to justify a war against another nation based on preemptive purposes?
Yes.
Is it a high crime to commit a felony via the submission of an official report to the United States Congress falsifying the reasons for launching military action?
Yes.
And on that last point, we need to remember that on March 18, 2003, within 48 hours of the invasion of Iraq having begun, the bombing of Baghdad having begun, the President sent an official document to the Congress in which he stated, signed document, that consistent with Section 3B of the Authorization for Use of Military Force Against Iraq Resolution of 2002, and based on information available to me, I determined that reliance by the United States on further diplomatic and other peaceful means alone will neither A, adequately protect the national security of the United States against a continuing threat posed by Iraq, nor likely lead to enforcement of all relevant United Nations Security Council resolutions regarding Iraq, and acting pursuant to the Constitution and Public Law 107-243 is consistent with the United States and other countries continuing to take the necessary actions against international terrorists and terrorist organizations, including those nations, organizations, or persons who planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11, 2001. If the President knew when he submitted this official document to the Congress that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, that the intelligence had been fixed around the policy, if he knew that there was no link to Al-Qaeda, this document constitutes a false statement under the False Statements Accountability Act, and it is a felony to commit a false statement, submit a false statement to the United States Congress. It is also a felony to conspiracy to defraud the United States Congress or any agency thereof, and this letter would constitute such. So where is the proportionality? Where is the proportionality? Where is the accountability? Accountability needs to start at the top. And if the President of the United States has committed felonies, he should be held accountable. And if the President has committed high crimes, he should be impeached. Faced with this radical departure from decades-old doctrines of U.S. foreign policy, the nation is at a crossroads, and the United States Constitution now faces perhaps its greatest test. Will the Constitution's purpose of countering unchecked power be fulfilled? Or will the President seize further monarchical powers in launching new preemptive wars against other nations? Will the Congress assume its exclusive duty to decide whether or not to send this nation into war? Or will it once again unlawfully transfer that decision-making power to the President? Will the federal judiciary intervene to protect and uphold the Constitution? Or will it once again remain on the sidelines? And how will we as a people respond? This is our Constitution. This is our document. It sets forth a series of promises by which to measure this nation. It creates a social contract between our government and the people. It provides, at the end of the day, our most important safeguard against the rule of any tyrant or would-be king. It is time to hold up the Constitution to the faces of those who dare to defy it. It is time to demand our country back. Thank you.
Attorney John Bonifaz of AfterDowningStreet.org. You're listening to the Citizens Tribunal on Iraq from Binghamton, New York.
I wouldn't even try to stop you guys, so. Thank you, John. Gita Gutierrez, it's funny, I called the Center for Constitutional Rights and I said, I need an international law expert. So they said, okay, we'll find you one. And they said, this woman, Gita's very interesting. I said, oh, okay, great. She's like, yeah, she knows about the St. Patrick's Four. I was like, no kidding. She's like, yeah, she's from Ithaca, the area. She's like, all right. This is going to be easy. Gita Gutierrez is a human rights attorney with the Guantanamo Global Justice Initiative of the Center for Constitutional Rights, specializing in the relationship between the laws of war, international human rights law, and anti-terrorism policies. Ms. Gutierrez was a member of the legal team for Rasul versus Bush before the United States Supreme Court and secured the rights of prisoners in Guantanamo Bay to access the federal courts. She also works with a coalition of legal organizations, human rights groups, and law firms challenging the Bush administration's policy of detentions and interrogations beyond the reach of law in the name of the war on terrorism. Once again, thank you for standing with us in the St. Patrick's Four, Gita Gutierrez.
Thank you for inviting me here today, and some of the Gradys actually are my neighbors, and so it's a true privilege, both as a lawyer and as a human being, to be here, and as a neighbor, to join you tonight. I first want to thank the Gradys and Daniel and Peter for their act, and for... for me, as a lawyer doing this work, and as a in-the-trenches human rights lawyer, having this trial occur now in September 2005 reminds me that at one point we didn't have a lawless government, and we got here somehow. It brings me back to that time in 2001 and early 2002 when the Bush administration raised the question of a preemptive strike or a preemptive war, and it was questioned. Often in the work that we're doing now at the Center for Constitutional Rights, that time seems to have long passed. So I thank you for your protest, and I thank this community for creating these panels and this dialogue and discussion and reminding us that there is a body of law that governments, including our own, are supposed to abide by, that we have strayed far from. I also want to preface what I'm going to say is it's going to be a very different presentation than my esteemed and brilliant colleagues who have outlined a great deal of the policies and legal issues that are triggered by what happened in Iraq and what is currently happening. I am a practicing lawyer, I have to say tonight that this is inspiring to be here with you, and it's also a difficult evening to be here in light of what our clients are going through right now. Our organization represents people who are victims of the torture at Abu Ghraib. We are representing individuals who are currently detained in Guantanamo and are engaged in a hunger strike where they're being force-fed in their own act of civil disobedience, where they, like the St. Patrick's Day Four, being willing to put their lives on hold and go to jail for what they believe in. The men right now in Guantanamo are willing to die until they get a fair hearing in federal court with a lawyer and understand why they're being detained in Guantanamo. So my mind and heart are heavy right now with thoughts of them. With those qualifiers, I want to talk to you a little bit about the international law framework that's implicated by what our government, what President Bush and Rumsfeld did by invading Iraq. And I also want to touch upon the international law that supports the actions of the St. Patrick's Day Four and supports acts of nonviolent civil disobedience. This is a form of protest that, as many of you know, and as the faith traditions that many of you come from, it's a form of protest that has long been recognized and supported when countries reach the point that ours has, when a government is no longer abiding by either its own laws or the laws of nation. Citizens do have a responsibility to protest and try as best they can to effectively prevent what their government's doing. As a simple legal matter, contrary to what your current judge may think, there is a great deal of basic legal support for engaging in civil disobedience. And one is to prevent your own individual complicity in what your government is doing. At this point, probably many of us here have attempted to vote. That hasn't worked. We have engaged in demonstrations. That also has not seemed to work to date. We're still engaged in the kind of conduct that we were in 2002. We have exercised our right to free speech. We've done nonviolent organizing. We've done many, many things. And those actions, those lawful means of grievance, those lawful means of expressing our protest have not altered our administration's course on the kind of lawless criminal behavior that both Scott and John have outlined. In those instances, as other people have mentioned, individuals have a responsibility to engage in civil disobedience or have a right to engage in civil disobedience to prevent their own complicity in a violation of international law. That right to engage in civil disobedience overrides your own government's obligation for obedience to its unlawful behavior. So the effort to prevent your complicity gives rise to a right to engage in civil disobedience. There also is a strands in international law that will support engaging in civil disobedience as a measure of self-defense or a necessity of self-defense of others, which is also something I believe I saw on the St. Patrick's Day 4 website. There's references to that kind of defense for engaging in civil disobedience. So it's something that we see practiced in international law in a variety of countries in a variety of areas and would support what's happening today in our own state. When we look at the violations of international law that have occurred in Iraq, I would put them in two different categories. And I would also say that in many ways this law is boring, and it's supposed to be. In times when emotions are high, when passions are inflamed, and governments wish to go in and obliterate another country, or a group of people wish to attack another group of people out of vengeance, the law is supposed to step in and provide a rule and a reasoned means of resolving a conflict that doesn't result in acts of vengeance or the kinds of unlawful behavior that we're currently engaged in. So the law that outlines a country, in this case our country is acting in the form of President Bush and his executive powers, but international law governs a sovereign territory, a sovereign country's ability to engage in acts of war. And the restrictions on our country's ability to attack another country are really, I think, very simple and very clear. So there's a decision to go to war. That's the first piece of this. And then there is our conduct in that war. So I'm going to talk about that in just a moment. The decision to go to war is governed by the UN Charter under international law. And there's an article of that charter that prohibits a country from engaging in an act of aggression or to violate the sovereign integrity of another country. And just to remind us of what this looks like in a normal world or in a regular day before President Bush got elected and then before he got picked. I know, that's true. When was he elected? Usually, this article comes into debate around things like the humanitarian interventions. So in international law, conflicts are divided into two categories. There's an internal conflict where you might have a civil war or you might have a separatist movement or a movement for independence, and it's an internal conflict. It doesn't involve any outside country. And then there's an international conflict. The war going on in Bosnia was classified or categorized as an internal conflict, but at the same time, there was genocide going on, and there was a huge debate among the international community about whether outside countries should go in, step in, and prevent what was happening. Similar situation in Rwanda. There you had an internal conflict that was leading to extraordinary numbers of death and extraordinary human suffering that countries could have prevented. But there's a huge debate about when to step in and when not to. And actually, when the United States intervened in Bosnia, there was some criticism among the international community for stepping into that internal conflict. And When you back up away from the individual situations, you can see why. Who gets to judge when we step in and when we don't? Who gets to judge when to violate the sovereign integrity of another country and support one side of an internal conflict? When a conflict becomes an international conflict, that's a different situation, and that's when the laws of war, the international humanitarian law, will step in, governing the conditions of the war, and the laws of war govern when a country gets to decide to attack. Another example was Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait. That was an act of aggression. It was not an example of an internal conflict. That was an example of an act of aggression. Saddam Hussein invades Kuwait. He invades a sovereign territory. There was a very swift criticism from the United Nations, and he was forced out. When countries do decide to actually attack another country, there is a process in the United Nations that involves the UN Security Council and a series of measures that must be exhausted, non-violent, non-military measures that must be exhausted before a country can pack up its army and send them into another sovereign nation. Even when those measures are exhausted, it still requires the intervention of the UN Security Council to authorize an attack upon another country under most circumstances. The United States and Iraq did not do that. President Bush's decision to invade Iraq was not supported by international law. It was an act of aggression. It's been called many things. The euphemism that it was a preemptive strike was an effort to invoke a self-defense clause for countries attacking another country, that because Iraq could attack us at some day, or because they had purportedly had weapons of mass destruction, the United States could preventively act in self-defense. That was not a concept that's recognized among the law of nations. That was something that President Bush made up, among many other things that he made up, to justify an attack upon another country. Once we decided to disavow that body of international law and go ahead and attack Iraq, there's a whole plethora of laws that we then chose to ignore that involve the treatment of prisoners once they're captured. The Geneva Conventions, which probably most people here are familiar with at this point, are a body of treaties and a body of law that is good law in the United States, most human rights lawyers would argue, and certainly governs the conduct of nations amongst each other. And the Geneva Conventions dictate the categorization of people who are picked up during an armed conflict. They set forth the kinds of protections and rights they need to have. They would never allow prisoners to be paraded naked. They would never allow prisoners to be threatened with dogs. They do not allow the rape or sexual abuse of prisoners. They require prisoners to be treated humanely. They require prisoners to be visited by the Red Cross and not kept off records or not kept off prisoner rolls. The way that the United States has engaged in the war in Iraq violates the Geneva Conventions and violates other treaties that would normally protect civilians that are picked up during wars. So when you think about the international law dealing with Iraq, it's both our initiation of the war and it's also how we've treated prisoners who we've picked up and the kinds of indiscriminate bombing and attacks that we've done in Iraq against the civilians there. Stepping back and looking at international law issues in our country now and looking at the connection between Iraq and this government's so-called global war on terror, we find that this administration has walked away from domestic and international law on a number of fronts beyond what we've done in Iraq. Iraq is one piece of a much larger picture of this administration's power grab that's nearly unprecedented, I would argue, in the history of our country. It rises to a level of governments or judges, it rises to the level of state officials who defied Brown versus Board of Education when the desegregation decision came down. And state officials who stood outside of schools and said, we do not care what the courts say, we do not care what the federal government says, this is our backyard and we're not listening to the rule of law. And that is the point that we've reached now, except now we've gone far beyond our own country. We are impacting the entire global community and setting a precedent for other countries to disregard, and other countries with far more questionable human rights records than our own, to disregard protections for individuals who are picked up on suspicion of alleged acts of terrorism, for individuals who may be Muslim, for individuals who may be Arab. They are picked up and put into a lawless process that we have set a precedent for, and that is something that's going to impact generations. The degree of lawlessness, I would argue, goes beyond what we've done in Iraq, and it looks at things like the discussions about attacks in other countries that we hear media reports about. God forbid the United States go beyond Iraq and start choosing the next country that's going to have purported weapons of mass destruction, or perhaps does not have a strong enough terrorism policy, and that justifies a preemptive strike. We have set a precedent that we are not backing off of. We are engaged in unlawful detentions in Iraq, in Guantanamo, in Afghanistan. We are sending individuals that we pick up or request other people to pick up and putting them in detention facilities in Syria, in Egypt, and Saudi Arabia. We are engaging, as Scott described, in a policy of torture. This is no longer rogue acts of individual soldiers. These are young men and women who exercised extraordinarily bad judgment and engaged in criminal behavior, but did so through a lack of guidance and through policies that endorsed the tactics that were used on prisoners in Iraq and in Guantanamo and in Afghanistan. And we are also engaged in practices of lawless rendition, extraordinary rendition, where the United States, in the name of the global war on terror, will pick up an individual in another country and ship them off to Syria or Egypt or a boat and allow them to be engaged using methods of torture and cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment in order to get information that's fed to our intelligence services. And there are individuals now who have survived this practice and are bringing legal challenges to it. When any of those cases get to a point where records or evidence of these practices needs to be brought before a federal judge, the United States invokes a doctrine called state secrets. These state secrets that we have right now are threatening our own community and threatening the global community, and we need to reach either through our civil disobedience, through a judicial system that needs to step up to the plate, or through our own political system, we need to reach a point where we have transparency around these policies and around these practices.
Human rights lawyer Gita Gutierrez.
I just want to end with an observation that it truly is astounding to me how little the rule of law means to this administration, and it's had profound effects on many, many individuals, from victims of the war, global war on terror, to victims of other policies that the administration has chosen to ignore. I think that the acts of civil disobedience that we see the individuals the acts of civil disobedience that we see with the St. Patrick's Day 4 are being replicated in Guantanamo, and I want to bring us back to that. Because we don't have a lot of information about what's happening to the prisoners who are in Iraq, but we are starting to get a little bit of information from the prisoners in Guantanamo. And many people describe the hunger strike or would describe acts of civil disobedience as desperate, and I try not to use that word ever. I think it is a severe and serious commentary on the escalation of this crisis of lawlessness that individuals are willing to go to these measures to protest and to refuse to be complicit or participate in the criminal and also immoral conduct that our administration is engaging in. So I commend the St. Patrick's Day 4 and this community. Thank you.
Human rights lawyer Gita Gutierrez. You're listening to the Citizens Tribunal on Iraq from Binghamton, New York.
Nadil is going to be the first.
Excuse me, hold off, everybody. I have something important to say. I'm Nabil Alaboudi. I'm Iraqi-American. My father is an Arab from Iraq. My mother is from Chicago, Illinois, of English-Irish descent. I was born in America. I grew up in Iraq. I'm bilingual, bicultural. I carry a degree in political science. I'm here to offer support to the St. Patrick's Four and to give testimony to the Citizens Tribunal on Iraq. Long time ago, in the 80s, a friend of mine from Salvador told me, everybody knows what the right thing is to do, but nobody is ready to be the first one to die. Thanks to the St. Patrick's Four and all of you here, today I'm ready to be the first one to die. So I offer you this testimony. This has to do, last summer I went to Iraq and I met with my cousin and a number of people in his neighborhood, and he told me what happened exactly about the explosion at the building of the United Nations. What my cousin and his neighbors told me, who live in the area where the United Nations is, that the area was sealed off a day before by United States forces. A diameter of an area of 5 miles all around the United Nations building, which is secluded. It's not in a residential or commercial area, so you can't get there. It was sealed so well that no one can get through except if the military allows them to. The next morning, a truck was placed under the office of Sergio de Mello, the envoy of Kofi Annan, and it exploded just when he had a meeting, killing him and a lot of other people there. Also, engineers in Baghdad, Iraq, have studies that a couple of missiles were fired at Sergio de Mello's office, killing him. That was blamed on terrorists. Reality is that it was this administration that killed Sergio de Mello in cold blood. They murdered him. Now, we all ask the question why, which is very important, why? As you all well know, the United States entered war with Iraq outside the offices of the United Nations. So it's an illegal war. After the war, after the occupation happened, after the invasion, Kofi Annan sent Sergio de Mello over there, who met with everybody, every political leader, religious leader, tribal leader, even the man on the street, everyone. And he came back to the United Nations and gave his report. An item of his report was that the occupation forces must announce a withdrawal schedule to obtain security. That did not sit well with this administration because they do not intend on leaving. They never did, they never will. So they killed him. And with this style of murder and intimidation, they obtained another resolution from the Security Council saying that, or stating that, occupation forces can remain in Iraq until security is obtained, thus offering legitimacy to an illegal occupation. Now, Martin Luther King said, there comes a time when silence is betrayal. I leave this information in your hands, and you do what you want for it. I put my life on the line. Anyone who has any doubt, is welcome to come with me to Baghdad and interview every house in the area. And we need to get to the bottom of this and get rid of King George once and for all. Thank you.
Very briefly, my name's Adam Flint, and I teach human rights and social movements at Hartwick College. I have one comment and one question. The comment, which is a suggestion, is that all of the presentations here be first published on the St. Patrick's 4 website and then hopefully very widely in the mainstream and alternative press, because I think this is great testimony that we can work with to bring down King George. Excellent work. My question is this. From what all of you have said and from other sources, it's clear this administration plays hardball when it comes to power. They act with impunity. Scott Horton, you're on the Council on Foreign Relations, I see. You probably know a lot about what's happening in the corridors of power in Washington. And my question to you and the rest of the panel is, what chance do you think there is that President Bush's suggestion that as a result of what happened with Hurricane Katrina, that Posse Comitatus, the law that says that the Army and the armed forces cannot engage in domestic law enforcement, can now do so? The implication is clear. Thank you.
Thank you. That's a very important question, actually. The Posse Comitatus Act was passed in 1878. It's a Reconstruction-era act, and it severely restricts the space within which the Army and the other branches of the uniformed services can act domestically in the United States. Today, Arlen Specter held hearings on Capitol Hill looking into allegations that Mohammed Atta, who was one of the 9/11 hijackers, had in fact been identified at least 1 year before 9/11 by a military intelligence unit. The Defense Department instructed the military officers who were summoned to testify at that Senate hearing not to appear and testify. And I know why. Because if that information had been developed, if they were to have testified honestly about what they were doing, what Operation Able Danger was, it would have made clear that a program exists within the Department of Defense right now, which is a direct violation of the Posse Comitatus Act. Now, if you watched George Bush's theatrical presentation on Jackson Square in New Orleans with the illumination of the Cathedral of St. Louis in the background, which, by the way, Brian Williams of NBC tells us was illuminated 30 minutes before he arrived and all the lights went off 1 hour afterwards. And special camouflage netting was put up all around the square so people wouldn't be able to see how disastrous the situation was. So this is our Potemkin president, by the way. But if you actually listened to that speech, you would have heard about 10 minutes into it, suddenly he said, one of the lessons we draw from this disaster is the utility that the military can play domestically, the important role they can play domestically. And what he's doing is building up for a proposal to change the Posse Comitatus Act, to legalize after the fact illegal things that are going on right now. And ladies and gentlemen, we've seen many disasters in this administration, and this could be the last one.
I just want to add one thing to this. Earlier this year, President Bush, or at least someone from the White House, was fielding the possibility of passing legislation to allow the military to operate domestically, and this was long before Katrina. Similarly to the fact that Bush's oil friends were looking to invade Iraq long, long, long before September 11th. They're looking for excuses.
Yes, I was creating part of this disturbance because I was checking on the internet as we were speaking to see if Senator Specter was going to make comments about this. And yes, he made a comment that has just appeared on the press service in the last 30 minutes condemning the Department of Defense for blocking this inquiry. So I think there's a reasonable chance we're going to see some turnaround in Congress and some attempt to really get at the bottom of this. But, of course, we've been dealing with a brain-dead Congress for the last 2 years, and it needs to be infused with new brain cells in 2006. But I will tell you, from having spent several weeks now dealing with nothing but Republican senators, there are an awful lot of them now who see that it would be very useful to demonstrate that there's some space between themselves and President Bush. And this could be one of the issues on which they'll do it.
I'm gonna ask, for the sake of time, that you not applaud. We all love what's being said. Let's get through as many questions and answers as we can.
My question is for either Gita or Scott, and it has to do with Nuremberg principles and whether they really are actual standing. What is their standing in U.S. law, if any? And I mean, I know that we've violated them, but what what does that mean? So this is sort of a twofer. How would you go about enforcing some of the violations of international law? So.
If we had a prosecutor who was brave enough, a federal prosecutor in the United States, they could indict certain officials in the administration, and it would be a question about immunity, as people mentioned before, whether government officials would have immunity from the conduct that they engaged in. As far as citizens or victims of this unlawful behavior, there are civil actions that can be brought for non-citizens, Iraqi citizens, men from Afghanistan, families who have relatives in Guantanamo, are able to bring civil actions that raise these violations as the basis for orders preventing the government from engaging in that kind of conduct in the future. There are, the interesting thing about military law in the United States, enforceable military law actually implements a great deal of the humanitarian law, the Nuremberg Principles, Geneva Conventions, those kinds of international law that may not necessarily we think of as enforceable rules are actually implemented by the Law of War Desk Book, by Army regulations that apply to all the service branches. And those laws are applicable in very boring ways under the Administrative Procedures Act. And there are there's litigation right now that's relying upon those in various ways to enjoin the government from doing what it's been doing.
Maybe I can just make a few more rather technical points about this. One, the Nuremberg Principles, and particularly the six Nuremberg Principles, were presented first as a declaration of the foreign policy view of the United States, the U.S. view of international law. Two, the London Agreement that formed the basis for the Nuremberg Tribunals, which was taken by a group of nations known as the United Nations. Three, it's subsumed into the United Nations Charter. Four, it's subsumed into the Charter of the International Criminal Court. So clearly it's established as a matter of international law very broadly. In fact, I don't even think, we could bring Jeremy Rabkin from Cornell, and I don't think he would deny the Sixth Nuremberg principle. But let me go back and say, too, when Justice Jackson was putting forward the Sixth Nuremberg principle, people asked him, are you saying that the United States itself would abide by this? And he uttered a really brilliant line, which I'm going to botch trying to repeat, but it was something like, we could not ask others to drink of this chalice. Were we not prepared to do so ourselves? And that's a line we got to remember.
And the customary international law and international law is a part of our United States Constitution. The Supremacy Clause includes the laws and treaties of the United States, and the laws of nation is part of our laws.
And every time that the defendants tried to bring that up in the trial, they were shut down. And they've tried many times.
I would like you, Scott, as well as the other two speakers, to elaborate on this, the question of the electronic voting machines and how that's our constitutional right to have every vote counted. and also the issue of the Valerie Plame.
And this is going to be really brief, right, because we're getting way off topic. But I just pointed out over dinner that the British government has refused to allow the importation of Diebold voting machines. The British government concluded that these were not reliable voting machines and denied them the right to be imported into Britain, and the Secretary of State of California has also refused to certify them. I mean, I think it's enough. I mean, really, and when you find voting officials who enthusiastically want to bring in Diebold voting machines and use them in a jurisdiction, they always seem to belong to one political party.
Well, what more you can use? If you wanted to relate it back to today, you know, as a kind of policy and practice matter, when people have engaged in civil disobedience throughout the world, one of the criteria before deciding whether to engage in nonviolent civil disobedience is whether you have a political process or some other means of grievances and protest. And when our government is fixing elections or making it impossible for us to protest with our vote and change our policies that way, then it does give more justification to using civil disobedience.
I would just add, in my capacity as general counsel for the National Voting Rights Institute, which is separate from my work with respect to this war, I happen to represent David Cobb and Michael Badnarik in their demand for a meaningful recount of all the votes in Ohio in the presidential election. And that case actually remains pending in federal court in Toledo on the question of whether or not the recount was done properly in accordance with basic constitutional principles. And I can tell you, based on the evidence that we've seen, that we have yet to receive any kind of proper counting of the vote. Now, with respect to the second part of your question on the Valerie Plame investigation, I would just say that part of the question here is what was the motive for outing Valerie Plame. And when we get to the motive, we realize that her husband, Ambassador Joe Wilson, was unveiling this cover-up that the administration has been and continues to be engaged in with respect to the lies that it told for getting this nation into war. And it's my view and the view of those at afterdowningstreet.org that the Valerie Plame investigation needs to include this question of why. Why did they go after her? Why did they out her? And when we get to that, we get to the underlying offenses of the lies told about this war.
Next.
Excuse me. This question is for Peter Orville. You say you were in the morning session when Peter and Teresa were found in contempt of court for mentioning the first trial. I was there in the afternoon, and there was some. He was found in contempt again for refusing to answer questions about who drew the blood and who drove them to the site and who was in meetings. Could you elaborate on this? Because this really worries me in terms of a dragnet trying to not just intimidate other peace activists, but actually draw us into a conspiracy net and charge us.
Very briefly, because I think we need to stay on topic, but yes, Peter DeMott was asked in cross-examination to name names of other people who helped him to draw blood and other possible unindicted co-conspirators. He said that he and the other three defendants took full responsibility for what they did and refused to name names. He was given many chances to name names, and he refused. He was held in contempt of court for that. On top of the other issue of talking about the trial. Next question.
I'm a little sort of confused about the Council of Foreign Relations. As far as I know, they've been on Park Avenue for a long, long time. We used to cover that corner in the New York City Police Department. And I've always been aware that it is the Council of Foreign Relations that makes our foreign policy. And that's a big part of the power structure in our country. Since you say you've been part of that, could you respond to what I'm saying? Everybody's saying in this country, where is the power structure? Who is the power? From what I understand, it is the Council of Foreign Relations. Could you comment on that?
Well, let me just say, I'm not representing the Council on Foreign Relations. I'm a member. It's a big membership organization. And the people who are members reflect all different perspectives on foreign policy organizations. But in fact, my experience, and I've been a member for about 12 years, is that it tends to be dominated and really run by whoever is out of office at any particular time. So really, the people who are running most of the programs right now are people who previously served in the Clinton administration. And I hope when the Bush administration is out, we're going to see a lot of them show up. I'd like to see that move on very quickly.
Well, the only thing I can conclude from your observation is that there's a heart and soul somewhere in the Council of Foreign Relations with a lot of you other people on a peripheral that may not even know what's going on in the basement in that power structure.
But it definitely doesn't make the foreign policy of the United States. I mean, it's an independent organization that comments on it. And there's an attempt within the council to form, you know, bipartisan consensus views on things. But, you know, very frequently we have meetings and there's raucous disagreement on things. I mean, as there was on the Iraq War when it began.
Good evening. My question is for the future when, God willing, we don't have George Bush or his ilk sitting in the White House. And I'm hoping to see that. My question is what happens then if we as a country don't hold them responsible for what has been done? You know, how is it going to be perceived and acted upon by people, both governments and citizens in other countries? Thank you.
I'll take a first stab at that. I remember that when George H.W. Bush left office, it was with a flurry of pardons. I remember Caspar Weinberger was pardoned, Ollie North was pardoned. It seemed to me there were quite a number of individuals who were pardoned. And I'd be very surprised if we didn't see history repeat itself with Bush II. And I think that's a big problem, because I think it is very important that there be, the word accountability was cited here. Remember, this was the responsibility president. You know, that was his mantra in his first election. This is the most utterly irresponsible government our country has ever had. And I think it's very, very important that on fundamental legal issues like the legality of the conduct of this war, that there is accountability on these things. And I think it's a responsibility of the United States and the citizens of the United States to be clear that we're the ones who hold them to account.
Can they be pardoned if they're not indicted?
Go ahead.
I just want to weigh in here that, first of all, we don't need to wait until this administration is over to hold them accountable. And in fact, there will be a new effort to hold George W. Bush accountable by certain members of Congress in the very near future. Now, I'm not able to tell you what that is. I can simply say stay tuned to afterdowningstreet.org, stay tuned to the alternative press, but in the next several weeks, there will be a new effort by some courageous members of Congress to hold this administration accountable, and it will be incumbent upon all of us as citizens to respond to that call with our own demands and our own support and our own voices. And I think that, you know, yes, it's impossible perhaps today to see how a Republican-led House of Representatives and a Republican-led Senate would hold a member of their own party accountable. But I think that we need to start that demand today. And if, in fact, in 2008, 2009, there is a greater will for it, so be it. But that demand needs to be made today. That's why we started AfterDowningStreet.org. It's a coalition of organizations all over this country and ordinary citizens demanding for this accountability.
I just want to add to that we are not alone in the global community. And the crimes that have been committed by this administration involve violations of the laws of war. They're international crimes, some of which countries can exercise universal jurisdiction. And it'll be 10 years from now, maybe it'll be 15 years from now. But the Pinochet trials, the prosecution, set a model for what can happen for world leaders who engage in the kind of activity that our president has.
Thank you. We're going to try to get two more questioners in, so go ahead.
My question is for Gita, I think. I was wondering if you could maybe comment upon how the war on terror is being used or could potentially be used not only to target people of Arab descent and Muslims, but also people of color, illegal immigrants, anarchists, etc. Thank you.
Sure. So we've already seen some of that. The tools and techniques that are being adopted by the administration in the so-called global war on terror are being used right now against, for example, animal activists that engage in, civil disobedience, perhaps not quite as nonviolent as some of the ones that are happening right now. But for protest groups in the United States, some of them have been targeted as terrorist organizations, and the new terrorism statutes are being used against them. The current conflict with some portion of Islamic terrorists, that's the engagement for the decade. Next decade, it may be a different group or a different political organization that the United States is fighting or thinks it's threatened by. But the tools that the administration is getting right now and the expansion of executive power is something that could be quite permanent. These tools have also been used against U.S. citizens. There's been United States citizens who, rather than being picked up and criminally charged, have been picked up and placed in military custody, designated as enemy combatants, held without access to a lawyer, held without access to trial. And that's a practice that was recently upheld by the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals and is currently most likely going to go to the United States Supreme Court for that executive power to be decided. So the things that we're seeing now are by no means limited to non-citizens or limited to people of Arab or Muslim descent.
All right. Thanks. I wanted to speak just a few sentences on the symbolism of blood, and you're right that the defendants were so eloquent. I have used blood, and my God, it's already there. We just refuse to see it. You know, we've sanitized everything, and it's such a powerful symbol, and it needs no words once the blood is there. Once you see the blood go up on the pillars of the Pentagon, it's there. Our hands are full of it. It's another way of making what's invisible in this strange society we live in visible in regard to plowshares, too, and the symbol of blood and hammering and the nonviolent witness. If you think about the ovens in Germany, and you think about what if the people had gone to the ovens and taken them apart before they were ever used, or spilled the blood to symbolize and to make visual the reality. I just wanted to give a few words about that.
You've been listening to the Citizens Tribunal on Iraq, held in Binghamton, New York, in conjunction with the federal trial of the St. Patrick's Four peace activists last month. Tonight's panel of legal experts were Scott Horton of Columbia Law School, John Bonifaz of AfterDowningStreet.org, and Gita Gutierrez of the Center for Constitutional Rights. MP3s of this and previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests can be downloaded from our website at www.unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.
Catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by unwelcome travelers.